Hey, good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, April 19, 2026. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater and your moderator for today. The share ID numbers for Friday, April 17th are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,377. That's 23,377. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,378. That's 23,378. This morning, A Vision for You presents, what are we conceding and why does it matter? Of all the 12 steps, which is the most important? Perhaps it has to be number one. Why do anything about a problem when you believe no problem exists? Everything begins here. A solid and good first step makes or breaks the recovery process. It is the solid foundation on which we have quality abstinence and recovery. Step one states, we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. The first step is so basic to recovery that the AA 12 and 12 says it is the only step that we can practice with absolute perfection. Step one is an admission of the central problem we face as weak compulsive overeaters. Our powerlessness over food and the unmanageable life that has resulted. Once we can admit our powerlessness, a door opens to the solution to our problem, and quality abstinence and recovery can be constructed. But step one is not merely an intellectual admission of powerlessness. It is an emotional acceptance of our powerlessness made at the gut level. The AA 12 and 12 refers to this acceptance of powerlessness and unmanageability as an experience of utter defeat, bankruptcy, hopelessness, and hitting bottom. As the AA Big Book says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were, for us, compulsive overeaters. Joining us to elaborate on this topic is Pete B., a recovered compulsive overeater from Pennsylvania. Pete is committed to the 12-step way of life and to carrying this message of recovery. And it's with great appreciation and always a pleasure to have Pete B. on the line. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, Leah. Thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you so much for all your service that you do for A Vision for You and to compulsive overeaters from, I guess, all over the world. And so I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and talk with my fellows, the folks I hear on the line, the folks I don't hear on the line. You know, it's just great to be here. I love A Vision for You. I must love it. I spend, you know, pretty much 2 hours a day listening to it almost every day since I started in back in 2017. You know, and just before I jump into the subject, just a little bit about me. You know, I live in Haverford, Pennsylvania. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I've been recovered since 2017. You know, I've been, you know, up and down the scale by my heaviest, you know, I'm a garden variety compulsive overeater. The heaviest, you know, my heaviest weight is only, you know, a little bit over 300 pounds. And, you know, just like I was a garden variety alcoholic, it didn't make me more qualified or less qualified for my seat in recovery. And I'm grateful I'm here, right? And what I intend to do today is to talk about some things in my experience in recovery, and I'm hoping that what I put together is consistent with what the text says about the text says about the condition, and as well as what the text says about the solution. right? And I really want to be careful, and I want to say this with all sincerity. Like, you know, this disease, you know, makes me a person that's prone to delusional thinking. In spite of how sane I believe I've become, I'm still prone to delusional thinking, right? So, and the problem with people that are delusional is that usually they're the last one to know it, right? Usually, you know, they don't put locks and bars on insane asylum windows and doors to keep people from getting in, right? They want to keep people from getting out, right? So I'm just going to say, you know, I want to be consistent with what the literature says about the condition. And, you know, and I'm here to do what the recovery process asked me to do, which is step 12, which is to carry this message, the AA message, the message that's contained in the literature. So, you know, you don't have to worry about hurting my feelings or making me question anything. If I'm wrong, you know, bring it to my attention, give me a call, text, bring it up in the questions. I'm here to learn as I am, as much as I'm here to you know, teach, if that's even a thing, right? So what are we conceding and why does it matter? As Leah indicated, that's on page 30 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful for where we are, you know, in a vision for you now reading about this, right? The first step in recovery, right? We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. Has to be smashed, right? So this talk is based on my experience in Overeaters Anonymous and what I've come to understand from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the question I want to talk about is simple, but it's critical. What exactly are we conceding? And why does it matter, right? So what does it say? What does the book say? It says that, what are we conceding? We're conceding that we were alcoholics, right? Or in our case, compulsive overeaters, right? And the question sounds straightforward, but how we answer it determined everything about my recovery, right? Because if we misunderstand what we are conceding, we're likely to apply the wrong solution. You know, I spent 13 years. I have to say that again. It's almost 15 years in Overeaters Anonymous. You know, coming in, getting some relief, starting, restarting, coming back in. You know, treating Overeaters Anonymous like it was something different than alcoholism. And every time I came in and every time I went back out and came back in, I got the same direction, the same set of things. This is what you're supposed to do, right? Get abstinent, find a sponsor, read the literature, attend meetings, make calls, all those different things. And, you know, I got some improvement, you know, some things improved. I lost weight sometimes. I gained weight. I got kind of abstinent. I didn't get abstinent, but, you know, I got improvement, but there was no success, right? And the suggestions that I received, they were all great suggestions, but when it came down to it, it wasn't addressing the issue. And every time I'd leave and every time I'd come back, I'd try harder and harder and harder. So if I got to read, I'll read more, right? If I have to, you know, I'll find the best sponsor. I'll find different literature, supporting information from the literature. It has to be some kind of answer there. Attend, you know, more meetings, make more phone calls. I'd try harder and harder and harder, and I would fail and fall back harder and harder every single time. And the problem was, I didn't know what I was conceding. I didn't know what I was conceding to, right? My, you know, the 13 years, if I was taking a lie detector test, I would swear I was never going to return back to the food. And yet, for some reason, I turned back to the food. And I believe an element of that problem is I didn't understand what the problem was. You know, it got to a point where finally, after a number of years of trying and failing, I just justified and rationalized that, you know, maybe it's not that bad, right? Like, I wasn't 500 pounds. You know, I wasn't 90 pounds. You take 70 pounds, 6'3", you take 70 pounds, you spread it over my body, it doesn't look that abnormal. And I thought, well, maybe I should just give up, right? And then I started to think at some point in time before I started attending a vision for you, well, if it wasn't that bad, why am I so miserable, right? Why am I feeling inspired and guided to be something that for some reason I'm unable to be due to this condition I have? That to me turned out to be incomprehensible demoralization. I had a desire to be something better, to be something more than I was, but I didn't have the ability to do it. And everything I could throw at it to try to fix it was not going to fix it. You know, I want to, before I jump into like what we're conceding, I just want to acknowledge, right, that, you know, in Overeaters Anonymous, there's many different types of eaters and many types of, you know, disorders. And what I'm going to talk about is my experience. It doesn't have to be everyone's experience, right? And you know, there's different approaches to this thing. And there are people that have different patterns of eatings and have different causes of their disorder, right? And this is just one specific experience. So I want to honor and respect those that have had a different or having a different experience than mine. And you know, the traditions say that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop compulsively overeating. You know, so I don't want to cause any kind of disruption. I just want to talk about my experience, right? But you know, the literature uses the term real alcoholic, right? And it uses it 8 times in the Big Book. I used to say 6, but I found 8 when I was going over this, right? So what does it say? It says in the doctor's opinion, in addition to the eight times, it says any picture of the alcoholic, which leaves out the physical factor, is incomplete, right? And so, you know, what drew me to A Vision for You is because A Vision for You was talking about compulsive overeating in the same context as they did alcoholism in AA, right? And I was, you know, I started thinking about that before I actually joined and actually started participating in the meeting. And I started listening to, you know, every day in A Vision for You, they say that there's a singleness of purpose, right? And the singleness of purpose is for us to identify as compulsive overeaters only. And so I started thinking about that. And, you know, before that, you know, I think prior to 2011, when they used to read at the OA meetings I went to, it says that they used the Big Book and they only replace food with alcohol, or alcohol with food, and alcoholic with compulsive overeaters. I think that's gone away. I think we're supposed to leave it all intact anyway. But when I started putting those things together, I started realizing that I was misunderstanding what I was approaching, right? Like, I was successful in AA because I put down the drink. But I thought compulsive overeating was different than alcoholism. I believed that the issue was behavioral, right? I thought I lacked discipline or like emotional regulation. I also believed that I was addicted to food, and just like a general sense, you know, and what was lacking was accountability and structure, fellowship and systems or practices that helped me stay on track. Right. I used to think of this thing like, you know, and I think this is common nowadays in the area of recovery, which is an area I work in, you know, that compulsive overeating is a spectrum disorder, right? Like they call alcohol use disorder or binge eating disorder. And I don't know if I necessarily subscribe to that. None of that information is in the Big Book. All I know is this: my eating, my drinking became disordered after I started, not before, right? That was the disorder. The disorder was not how much I was using. The disorder was once I started, I couldn't stop. Right. And that understanding, that misunderstanding, if you will, had a very predictable result. Right. I would improve for a period of time, and then I would return to the same behavior. Right. Nothing was stable. Right. I could do all the things I was asked to do, read the readings, do the assignments, pray for the certain amount of time, make the phone calls. And they all worked for a period of time, right? I get relief. I have the food down long enough to detox from some of them, and I get some relief. But essentially, at some point in time, I stopped doing them. I stopped doing them and they didn't work. Eventually I did them. I eventually would keep doing them and they didn't work. And the reason was I was in my plan of eating, and what I had decided was my quote unquote abstinence is it contained substances that triggered the phenomena of craving, or I was eating foods that if I ate them in to excessive quantities, they would produce the phenomena of craving. Right? So this, that just led on and on and on, year after year after complete, repeated relapse and ongoing confusion. I was like, this just doesn't work. And it wasn't that it didn't work. It was that I didn't understand what I was dealing with. I didn't understand what it meant to be a compulsive overeater. If I was truly addicted to food, then all food that I put in my body should have been a problem. But what happened was, what I recognized from the experience I was having, is when I get abstinent and I would detox, only certain foods that I would eat would actually trigger me, right? And A Vision for You, it intrigued me because it was the first time I ever heard the term alcoholic foods. It's also where I heard OA's definition of abstinence, right? And I started to think about the types of food that triggered my relapses. Now, look, I don't want to minimize this idea about, food addiction and food, and being addictive. I have an addictive personality. I'm now recovered and I'm still addicted to foods that are in my meal plan. I have addictions to people, to love, exercise. I'm addicted to meditation. I even get addicted to brands of food, generic brands of food. Like I only like certain foods from certain stores that sell this certain brand. It's part of who I am. Like trying to resist that is just, and trying to think it's a defect of my character. I've wasted years of my life trying to make that change. And I just had to realize that's what I am. Right. But it's not the fact that I'm addicted that caused me to gain, 45, 35, 45 pounds in a month. My addiction caused me to start eating, but it wasn't the reason why I kept eating. The reason why I kept eating is because something that either I was or I wasn't addicted to was triggering an abnormal reaction, right? There were only some foods that caused loss of control, right? Only certain foods. And they did something that was different from me that they didn't do to many other people that I knew from Overeaters Anonymous. Sometimes I could stop, but I couldn't reliably stop, right? It didn't have anything to do with how much I liked the food or I didn't like the food, right? There are foods that I don't necessarily like that trigger craving for me. And there are foods that I love and I'm probably addicted to that don't cause craving for me. I get ease and comfort from everything that I eat. That's not what makes me a compulsive overeater. That's what makes me a human being. That's why the way I'm designed. Food gives me ease and comfort. Ease and comfort doesn't trigger craving for me. So when I started questioning what was going on and reading what the literature actually says, that question changed everything for me. Because if the issue isn't all food, then my thoughts about how I was approaching recovery, right, the food with, you know, it's a food addiction, that whole thought might be incorrect for me. And I was baffled. I was baffled because food is different than alcohol. Right? Food's different from alcohol. When you stop drinking, say a Tuesday, by Thursday, alcohol's out of this system. You're not responding to craving. You're not responding to a biological demand that you put more alcohol in your system. You're responding to a mental obsession to drink. See, but the food, especially the food I'm eating, right? This food was created by some of the greatest scientists known to man. People have made these foods in a manner that caused me to want them more, right? They have substances and chemicals in them and biologically or altered chemistry that makes them something different. And they don't leave in 2 days. Right, these things sit around and linger, and I kept on wondering. I would get absent, and I'd be following the meal plan, eating like a Viking, you know what I mean? Like everything's weighed, measured, nothing in it, but yet I still craved food. And what I've come to understand is that, like I said, food toxicity is different than alcohol toxicity, right? And I recognize that, you know. If I had to not only put the food down, but I had to keep it down, right? And weighing and measuring and all of those things, they were all super, super important for me to after I put the food down, to keep the food down. Because, you know, weeks after the food was down for me, I kept on craving food, right? I kept on craving more things. And the only thing I can associate that with is that these things must still be lingering in my body. Because it took all of about 100 days for the foods to actually get out of my system and for me to stop feeling the phenomenon of craving. And that may be good news to people that, you know, it's coming, but it also might be bad news to people who are going through it and hoping it was going to end sometime soon, like it does with alcohol. It stuck around for a really, really long period of time. And like I said, you know, I was baffled. And after a while, I got tired of waiting. I got tired of talking about it. I got tired of thinking about it. And I just went back to the food. You know, the big book describes alcoholism having two components, right? A physical reaction and a mental obsession. This particular framework, you know, gave me a way to reinterpret what my experience was, right? Reinterpret what was going on, right? And it mentions in the big book 8 separate times we might as well, you know, and if it says something 8 separate times, we might as well, you know what it actually means to be a real alcoholic, right? And on page 20, it says, we see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are different from ours. On page 21, it says, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Right, on page 22, I'm going to read this. It says, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, what makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this, right? So this is telling me that the condition I have, right, this abnormal reaction starts after I consume the substance, not before, right? It's an abnormal reaction to certain substances. For the alcoholic, alcohol produces an abnormal reaction. For me, certain foods produce the same type of reaction. And once triggered, control was absolutely unreliable. I was aware of the physical component, right? I was aware of it when all the time I was in Overeaters Anonymous. But I just didn't take it as serious as I did alcohol. I'd minimize the severity of the condition and I tried to resolve the issue that I thought, you know, I tried to resolve the issues that I thought were driving me to the food. And I'm not saying that issues don't drive people to food, right? They do all the time, right? Because we get restless, irritable, and discontented, and we get ease and comfort from food. That is the case. But I minimized the fact that I would be able to. So I used to think that somehow, some way, after I triggered the phenomenon of craving, I would be able to rope in how much I would eat. And for at times, I would be able to. At times I'd be able to be okay with it. But what I didn't realize is that I had a progressive illness, right? The disease just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And once I started triggering the phenomenon of craving, my ability to control it after I started became less and less and less, right? You know, the mental part of our disease, like the big book says, that a greater aspect of disease is the mental part of our disease. Right. But what I had to realize is that obsession, the mental obsession, that precedes the drink, right? That precedes the use. See, because even when I knew the outcome, I would still return to food, right? That's what the mental aspect is. The obsession, that obsession that helps makes me override any logic in my mind or even and disregard all my prior experience. But I thought if the problem was mental, the way to fix the problem would be mental or psychological, right? Right? I'd learn how to identify what was happening in my head and in my heart, and I would assess it and evaluate my thoughts and feelings, made me focus on me. I would figure it all out, and then I wouldn't desire to eat, right? But I figured all that shit out. I figured all that stuff out. It wasn't driving me to eat. Food was driving me to eat. The key insight for me was that it's not everything, it's specific triggers. And the problem is not the food, the problem is me. And I can't fix me, right? The function of working these steps and doing the rest of the steps is not to fix me. The function of working the steps and doing the rest of the steps is to allow me to form a relationship with God. And what I found is that God can do for me what I can't do for myself, but God isn't going to do for me what I can do for myself. And what can I do for myself? Well, I can put myself into situations where I'm not going to use the food. I can take the appropriate actions to not put the food in my body. I can go to any lengths to make sure the stuff that I have in my house doesn't contain any of the substances that trigger the phenomenon of craving. See, what I found is the more that I focused on trying to fix me with processing my thoughts and, you know, trying to figure out from my history what I thought was the reason why I was a compulsive overeater, the more I focused on me, the greater the problem was. Because I started getting distracted from what the solution is. And I thought, oh, let me just fix this and I'm going to be okay. For me, I had to redefine the problem. It wasn't lack of willpower. It's not purely, you know, just emotions and not being able to process my emotions that's the problem. And it's not all food. Right? Food does not have any power unless I put it in my body. Just like alcohol doesn't have any power unless it's inside my body. I have to pick it up and put it in my body in order for me to be powerless over it. Right? There's a reason why step one that Leah mentioned earlier is in past tense. Right? It's in past tense. It doesn't say are. It says admitted we were powerless over food and our life had become unmanageable. Both terms in past tense. We don't have to pretend it says something differently. It's not afraid. I mean, we don't have to be afraid of it. I'm not claiming that I have any, that I have power that I don't have, but I do have agency. And that agency was given to me by the Creator. So what is it, right, that I had to concede? Well, I had to concede that, you know, the big book says that, you know, I had to concede that I react abnormally to certain foods, right? I can't safely consume them in any quantity whatsoever. I'll never, ever be able to. I won't be able to consume look-alike foods or smell-alike foods or things that I make out of abstinent food that looks like alcoholic food. Can't do any of that. I'll never, ever be able to safely consume them. It's not going to change, right? I'm never going to get better from that part of my, from that part of the disease. It doesn't improve. We think not eating can improve the condition. Well, not eating makes the condition worse. I had to accept that my reaction was fundamentally different than other people, even some people in Overeaters Anonymous, right? Because that means all people. I'm different from all people. That's what makes me not like other people, that my body reacts in a way that 90% of the people out there, it doesn't react the same way to, and that that's never, ever going to change. So what am I not conceding, right? Like if that's what I'm conceding, what am I not conceding? Well, I'm not conceding. It's not all food that's dangerous, right? It's not, you know. It's not, it, you know, it's not a blanket statement like everything, you know, this is not a blanket statement about all food or a judgment about willpower. It's just that it's not that I lack discipline. I was a disciplined person before I was in Overeaters Anonymous. I don't plan to ever not be in Overeaters Anonymous, but I had discipline. I was able to accomplish things that a lot of people weren't able to accomplish. I just couldn't understand why the one thing I wanted to accomplish for all my life, to be a fit, healthy, energetic, vibrant, articulate, competent man, I couldn't accomplish that because I would use food that was causing me to be something that I didn't want to be. Right? So it wasn't that I didn't have discipline. It was that I was using substances that took away my power to have any kind of influence over what else I was going to put in my body. Right? And I'm also not conceding, like, it's not, you know, emotions are, they're important, and we have to understand them. We have to understand what's going on, but they're not the primary issue. Right? They're not the primary issue. And I also want to be clear, I'm not implying that it's okay to eat as much as you like of stuff that doesn't trigger the phenomenon of craving, because weighing and measuring is an important aspect of my practice. It's an important aspect of my life and my existence. But weighing and measuring now is the means I use to make sure that I'm appropriately nourished the way I need to be nourished, with the right macronutrients and the right micronutrients. Weighing and measuring, right, my meal plan, that's a tool for recovery. That's not recovery. And I weigh and measure my food because I use food for its intended purpose, right? Like I said, to meet my dietary requirements, right? So I'm not, you know, saying, oh, well, it's not, you know, it's not an alcoholic food, so you eat as much as you want of it. You know, that's gonna make me fat, lumpy, bumpy, and, you know, restless, irritable, and discontented too. But I have a much better chance of eating the appropriate amount of foods if I'm not ingesting the substance that triggers the phenomenon of craving. And you know, why does concession matter? Like, why does it matter? Why do I have to concede that? Why can't I just call it all one thing? And maybe you can, but I can't. And I can't because, you know, concession, first of all, it ends my experimentation, right? Without fully conceding this particular fact, this physical reaction that I have to food, I kept on testing different foods, different things. I would try again, thinking this time it's going to be different. Well, concession for me, it removes that ambiguity. it either triggers the phenomenon of craving or it doesn't. I can't eat, you know, less sugar. You know, sugar is a problem for me. Lots of things are a problem for me. I can't say, well, I can have things with only certain, you know, the certain number on the ingredients list, then it should be okay, right? I can't eat, you know, low fat something or other, because if fat triggers craving, it's fat. Fat doesn't trigger craving for me. So there's no number, right? I had all this ambiguity built into my meal plan, and I kept on wondering why I'm so consumed, obsessed with foods. And it turns out, like I said earlier, I was weighing and measuring foods that trigger the phenomenon of craving. If it has it in it, I can't eat it. If it has it in it, I can't eat it. For the initial 100 days that I was in Overeaters Anonymous, this, you know, back in 2017, I basically ate five foods. They were pretty much single ingredient items. I ate just those because I knew they couldn't trigger the phenomenon of craving. I ate them in a weighed and measured, you know, fashion, because weighing and measuring was what I needed to address the problem that I came in, that was driving me in here, was I was overweight. So I had a meal plan that didn't include any of the substances that trigger the phenomenon of craving. It eliminated any confusion about what does or doesn't. That's just what I ate. And the phenomenon of craving went away. But it went away after a long time, right? You know, before I conceded, I was always testing and saying, what do you eat? What's on your meal plan? Oh, that's okay. Oh, I'll put that in mind, right? A lot of that, right? A lot of confusion. You know, is it fructose? Is it lactose? Is it glucose? Is it, is it this fiber, that fiber, that starch, right? And what did I get, right? My behavior was unpredictable. My results were inconsistent. I was always revisiting the same questions. It wasn't even like my life felt unmanageable. It felt like it was unlivable. You know, here I am thinking I'm supposed to be doing so well. I had years and years of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had, you know, put my life back together, acquired all these things, had the relationship in check, all that thing. And I'm thinking to myself, if I'm doing so well on paper, why do I feel so bad? And the reason why is because these substances kept triggering me, and I kept going back to the food, and I kept on feeling defeated, thinking I was doing everything you're supposed to do to produce the result they told me it would produce. And the key thing I wasn't doing was eliminating the substance, eliminating the ingredients, and eliminating the behaviors that were triggering the phenomenon of craving. So anyway, so going back again, right? So I want to go back again and say it again, right? Because this isn't Alcoholics Anonymous, it's Overeaters Anonymous. And there is diversity here, right? There are people here that they are triggered just from putting food in their body. There are overeaters, there are undereaters, there are bulimics, there are people of all different types of things, right? And there are different solutions. There are different solutions and workable plans and different things that you can do, and they work for a lot of people. So I'm not saying that this has to be, that this is only one model, right? But it's the one that seemed to work for me, eliminating the substance, right? Eliminating it entirely. And again, I'm not going to reiterate, look, I'm not advocating for overeating non-alcoholic foods. It's super, super important. But again, I'm going to say, you know, I never got triggered by an extra string bean, right? I never got triggered by, you know, not weighing my beef, right? I got triggered from an M&M or a Reese's Pieces, right? Like that was my experience. So, you know, getting towards the end of it here, right? So, like, my implications, right, for recovery, right? So, what can this apply to anybody else? I don't know. I'm totally fine being, you know, not like other people. If this has been only my experience, that's cool. That's cool. If you had a different experience, I appreciate you listening. right? But if you might be, or if you're someone like me who's been, you know, over a decade or decade and a half in the program and not being able to get and stay abstinent, maybe this would be helpful for you, right? Right. It was helpful for me when I came in. I was expecting to get the same set of instructions that I got all the other time, how many phone calls to make, how many times I got to go to a meeting. I expect to get all those things. I didn't get them. I didn't get them this time. I got directed to the big book. I got directed to the doctor's opinion. Told me that the only relief that we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Right. So, you know, could this have implications for your recovery? You know, identifying trigger foods from, you know, absolutely essential. Eliminating them entirely. Absolutely. 100% essential. Again, I can't go thinking I'm okay because there's some code word for a substance that triggers craving buried deep into the ingredients of an item I put in my body, right? I am in everything in my life, I am responsible and I am accountable. So I have to be sure, certain, 100% certain that what I put in my body doesn't contain any of the substances that trigger craving. If they trigger it, it has to be eliminated. And that's no one's responsibility except for mine. It's not the waiters. It's not the chefs. It's not my wife. It's mine. Right? You know, the mental obsession, I'll go back to that again, right? The mental obsession is a part of the disease that the book says is a greater aspect of the disease reminds in the mind, resides in our head. But guess what? I can't, you know, I could focus on that all I want. And I could work really, really hard at trying to correct my thinking, about trying to correct my behavior, about trying to adopt certain practices. And they're all great practices and great suggestions. But if I'm consuming substances that trigger craving for me, I mean, it's just a matter of time before I'm going to not be able to do any of those things because all I want to do is continue to eat those substances. That includes working on my relationship with a power greater than myself, right? Because the God I believe in, the God of my understanding, doesn't have requirements. God doesn't care if I'm drunk or sober or fat or skinny or rich or poor. That doesn't matter. My God wants two things for me. Wants me safe and protected. That's it. Safe and protected. Right, so even if I'm working on my relationship, I can't be safe and I am not protected if I'm ingesting substances that trigger the phenomenon of craving. Right? I just can't. Right? So I need clarity. Right? My problem was as much a lack of clarity as it was lack of power. And as soon as that clarity crept in, as soon as I got access to that clarity, this phenomenon of craving started subsiding and I started being able to put my thoughts, to put my behaviors, to put all those things to align myself with the way I think my God would have me be. And I started to get some of the things that they talk about in the program of recovery, right? I started to be, you know, I started to see that I am starting to get a level of sanity, a level of clarity. I'm able to handle situations that used to baffle me, right? But this, you know, this way that I was approaching it in the past on trying to fix these things and figure out where this is coming from, it just led to more and more frustration. There's application for that. There's application for that. Right, but what I knew for sure is I had to stop triggering craving. Oh, okay. So just for clarity, as I start to get down towards where I'm gonna end up on this thing, and hopefully it was clear. If it wasn't, that's fine too. But so what am I conceding? Right, what did I have to concede? I had to concede that there are certain types of food that I cannot safely use in any quantities whatsoever, in any situation, under any circumstances. And if I don't ingest them, there's a really strong likelihood that I'm not going to trigger craving. And if I don't trigger craving, there's a really strong likelihood that I'm not going to compulsively overeat. A really strong likelihood that I'm not going to compulsively overeat. You know, clarity on this issue. I'm so grateful for the recovered compulsive overeater that helped me through this process. And the way that they helped me through this process was not telling me what was in the big book. I had been reading the big book for 20 years before I came to A Vision for You. I always had big book studies, step studies. I spoke at national AA conventions. I did all of, I knew it was in the big book. Right? I didn't need her to tell me where it was. But she helped me understand how the information that was in the big book applied to compulsive overeating. Right? So I would encourage everyone, get a good sponsorship. Good sponsorship is important. It's really, really important. But if you have a sponsor that's not equipped with the information as it relates to the condition and has been conditioned to believe that, you know, the practices, the tools, the all of these things are the solution, you might be better served by ChatGPT or some other AI or something out there, right? Because the information is the information. I don't think anything I said was inconsistent with what the literature said. I'm sure some people are going to bring it to my attention if it was. But that's what it is. Right. That, you know, that's what it is. Right. So and I can tell you this. I had no by the time I came to A Vision for You and I got abstinent and worked the steps and entire abstinence before I started, I had no confidence that it was going to work. I actually thought to myself, I'm going to do it exactly the way the literature says to do it. I'm going to do everything that's suggested of me to do. And if it doesn't work, I'm going to go and get surgical solution to getting the fat removed once and for all, and I'm going to just go that route. And I did what it said to do, the way that it said to do it, followed directions that I received that were consistent with what the literature says, and I got what the literature says I'm going to get. I've been restored to sanity. Not restored to power, restored to sanity. I know what I am. I know what I'm not. I have access to all of the resources and faculties that the Creator has given me. I have the ability to process my feelings and my emotions. I have the ability to ask God to remove the things I'm having trouble with. I have the friends and the resources and support around me to discuss those things if I need to. And by being entirely abstinent, I've been delivered, and doing those things, I've been delivered to a life that is beyond my wildest dreams. So that's about 45 minutes. I'm going to stop there and hopefully open it up for some questions. And thank you again, Leia, for this opportunity. And then I'll pass.
Thank you, Pete, for this compelling, straightforward, and instructive presentation this morning. Certainly a gem for the archives. I'm sure it will help many. Today's share ID, 23,379. That's 23379. Pete's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so do stay tuned for that. We will now transition to a question and answer segment. You have the opportunity to pose any questions to Pete. And you can do so by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name. Who has a question?
Maggie.
Maggie.
Jason.
Simone.
Jason.
Simone H.
I'm sorry, I'm not catching that name.
Simone.
Celine.
Simone. Thank you.
Ken W. H.
Kate J.
Kate J. Let me tell you
Celine
who I have. There we go. Celine, thank you. Thus far, I have Maggie, Jason KP, Simone, Ken WH, Kate J, Celine M. Who did I miss? Any other members like to ask a question? Star one to unmute. Okay, let's get started with this list. Maura, okay, we'll put you there on the list. Okay, let's get started with Maggie. Questions only, please. Thank you. Maggie.
Hello, yes, thank you. Thank you for your service. I'm Maggie A. from Massachusetts, and my question for Pete is, you were talking about triggers, and you were mentioning that you don't eat foods that even, I think you said, look like or taste like resemble your trigger foods. Did you mean even if they don't have any of the ingredients that are your trigger foods? So maybe you were, I think you might have been saying that it would trigger like a psychological, even if the ingredients weren't in there, because it looked and tastes similar to trigger foods. So I just wanted you to clarify that and talk about that a little more. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Maggie. I appreciate that. I apologize too if that wasn't clear. What I was referring to is that I was eating a lot of things that were made with like concentrated juices or artificial, you know, substitutes for the things that trigger the phenomena craving. And I was thinking that was okay. You know, I was the kind of person that, yeah, well, it's not the thing that everybody says you can't have if it's the fifth ingredient or less. It's not that thing. It's something else. And look at the person right next to me. She's got one of those things too. Right? So there were things that, you know, were quote unquote okay. I mean, I even had a sheet one time. It was it had a color on it, and that color had a food on it that it said I could have one thing a day. And that one thing a day triggered the phenomenon of craving. Another example of that is that I would combine quantities of foods that I thought were okay because I could eat them in one, I would combine them into a form that would cause me to have too much. I don't want to get into specific things, but they would trigger the allergy for me. And I realized that I can't eat those combination of ingredients because they don't work for me. And so that's essentially what I was referring to. I hope that clears it up for you.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Maggie A. Jason KP.
Good morning, Jason KP here. Pete, I appreciate calling my attention to the past tense statements of step one. Could you maybe speak more to it, especially the second half? Is your life unmanageable now? Are our lives unmanageable after we've had a spiritual awakening as a result of the 12 steps? Thank you.
Sure, that's a good question, Jason. I'll ask you one. How could my life be unmanageable if I turned it and my will over to the care of God as I understand God? I don't.
Is that, is that rhetorical, or did you want to talk a little bit?
No, but I'm saying it's not my life. I made a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand God. So by definition, it can't be unmanageable because I'm not managing it. I'm getting to a point. I have to get to a point where I have to trust and rely that what is going on in my life is God's will. My job is to change it if I can and accept it if I can't. That's what my understanding, right? The job of the steps, particularly steps three, is to figure out how to align my will with God's. So if I'm aligning my will with God's and I turn my life and will over to care of God. God, I offer myself to thee. Well, then it's no longer my life. I'm no longer the one that's supposed to determine the details of it. So no, it's not unmanageable because it's not mine. It's God's. Now, do I struggle? Yeah, I struggle because I'm human. I want things the way I want them. I want people to think the way I think, to look the way I want them to look, to feel the way I want them to feel. I want that all to occur. Right? But I accept the fact that I can't. That's God. That's what God's will is. So I hope that made sense. It makes sense to me.
Makes sense to me. Thank you, Jason, for the question. Simone, your turn. Star one to unmute.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you, Pete. What a great talk. And thank you, Leah. My question is that I'd love to hear more on how you work through your feelings and emotions in your recovered state, no longer using food. How does it work?
Yeah, thanks, Simone. I appreciate that. So how do I do it? I do it the way that the big book instructs me to do it. I keep a constant lookout, right? I keep a constant awareness, and I watch out for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When things crop up that I don't know what they are, I sit down and I ask, what's going on here? Of myself, what's going on here? What is this? Oh, it's fear. That's dishonesty. I'm not looking at it from every perspective. That's, selfishness. That's self-centeredness. And then when I realize what it is, I ask God to remove it. That's what the instructions are. I ask God to remove it. If I happen to have done something as a result of selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, and I harm someone, I have to figure out right away how to make amends for it. Usually when that happens for me, that's when I discuss it with somebody if I can't figure it out. I discuss it with somebody and help me understand what the amends is. And I make the amends. After I do that, I direct my attention, and this is what I do pretty much on a regular basis. I direct my attention to somebody I could be helpful to. That might be a lady crossing the street. It might be the person behind me at the store I'm feeling restless here, or I'm feeling selfish and dishonest about, whatever the case may be. But I have to get the problem that talks about the problem, selfishness and self-centeredness. That is the root of the problem. So the more time I spend in selfishness and self-centeredness, the more time I'm spending in the problem. I've got to ask God to do what God does, is to remove that, right? The more time I spend, juggling it around and figuring it out and researching why and where did that come from and who that is, that's all self-centeredness. Now, is it good to have assistance with that when I first get started? Yeah, because why? Because I've been affected by these substances and these behaviors and these beliefs that I've had my entire life. Right? But is it good to have somebody to coach me, to guide me, to help me figure that out? Absolutely. But does that mean for the rest of my life I'm never able to utilize my ability to discern what's happening in my life? Right? Does that mean that I'm forever broken and I can't ever handle a little bit of disappointment? Right? That my mind is so broken and irreparable that I can't address some emotional disturbances without first talking it over with somebody, writing it out, emailing it to 20 people and getting feedback from it? Not indefinitely, right? That's not, the big, for step 10, it talks about growing in understanding and effectiveness. That doesn't sound effective or efficient to me. It might be for other people. Like I said, that's all fine and dandy. But when I read the instructions on how to handle those things, that's how I read those instructions to be. That's when you're figuring them out grammatically, that's what they say to do. Now, people have other practices to do that, and it works splendidly for them. Great. But telling people that that's the only way that they're going to be able to get through the day, that's directing people to rely on human power and other people. And we have specific instructions in the Big Book on what we're supposed to tell people to depend and rely on. And if we put other people ahead of what we're supposed to depend and rely on, then we're always going to be dependent on something that's going to fail us. At some point in time, it's going to fail us. And I can't take that, right? So it's good, you know, have someone help you get through it, but it's not like we're indefinitely broken and we're never going to be able to process these basic human emotions. I don't read it anywhere in the Big Book that says that's the case.
Thank you, Simone, for your question. Ken W.H., your turn.
Thank you, Leah. This is Ken W.H. out of North Carolina. Thanks, Pete. Good to hear you. Excuse me. Question. Jason started to touch on it for me, and he took the second half of the first step. I'm just looking at the first half, and you talked about it in past tense. It says we were. And I have to remember that Bill is writing on behalf of the first 100 and himself, so he's speaking in a collective sense, so that, therefore the we. I personally, among those we's, have to admit my powerlessness over food. Now I am in abstinence. I have been healed of a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Am I no less powerless? That's my question.
Thanks, Ken. Good to hear you, too. I don't know what you are. I only know my experience. And my experience is this. There's only one way that food has ever gotten into my body. That's either with my right hand or my left hand. I've never been pulled into a bakery and instructed to or forced to put anything in my body, regardless of whether I was doing it, under the phenomenon of craving or not. I made a decision to ingest those substances, right? And if the fact is that these substances don't have any power, they don't have any power. The only way that I can be powerless over them is if I put them in my body. And if I don't put them in my body, they don't have any power over me. Now, when I have the phenomenon of craving, it's opposite of that. Once I ingest them, I don't have control. I'll never have control, and I won't be done eating until the substance or my disease decides that I'm done eating. So, like I said, I don't know what you are. I know what I am. And I'm what the Big Book says. I've been restored to sanity. I have right mind. I know what's going to happen if I put those things in my body. Now, I also have a mind, like I said, that's prone to delusion. Can I go back? I guess I could. But, you know, the Big Book is written and has specific results, not promises, that says are supposed to come about if I do the things that it says to do in entire abstinence. So I don't know. You tell me what you think that means.
Well, I don't think that's the forum for it, so we'll talk sometime.
Okay.
Thank you, Ken W.H., for the question. Kate J., your turn to ask a question.
Good morning. Thanks, Leah, and thanks, Pete, for your talk this morning. Always appreciate hearing your perspective. You talked about this being a spectrum disorder, which I would completely agree with. My question is, what do you do with a sponsee or potential sponsee who comes to you and has a completely different experience from you in regards to certain foods or behaviors? Do you send them to someone else? How do you guide them?
So thanks, Kate, for the question. I was also saying I don't subscribe to the fact that this is a spectrum disorder. The results of eating might be on a spectrum. Like some people may be morbidly obese or, you know, concentration camp skinny. The results are. But to me, the phenomenon of craving either occurs or it doesn't. But, you know, to answer directly your question, right, and here's the reason why I say that. They have medicine that can be prescribed that can reduce the desire to eat food. It can reduce the desire to drink alcohol. It's in the paper. It's on the news. You know, you read, it's out there. But they don't. I don't believe they have a substance that's going to change the reaction I get to those foods. And while it could lower my desire for them, it's not going to change the fact that I have an abnormal reaction. And if I eat those things or drink alcohol, I'm going to trigger the phenomenon of craving. So I don't subscribe to, you know, whether it's good, you know, it's only a little bit compulsive overeater. I'm either alcoholic or I'm not. And so how do I offer instruction? First thing is, you know, we talk about how, you know, different voices and all those things. I mean, the convincer is Nabisco, Ben and Jerry's, Entenmann's, Dunkin' Donuts. That's what convinces somebody what they have. I can't, you know, if somebody says, you know, I'm okay eating, you know, agave nectar because it's, you know, it's organic, and I can't tell them, no, you're not. I can't, first of all, I'm not working with anybody, and I don't think anybody should be working with anybody to fix them. I work with people to help me, just like the way Bill Wilson left the Mayflower Hotel in Akron. He left the hotel to help himself, to help somebody else. So my job is to help them review the information that's available. And if they're not, if they eat a different way or we eat a different way than me, it's not my business. The food's going to determine if it's okay or not, and if they can manage it, and if they can, great. And if they can't, we'll revisit it and we'll go back. Where, you know, what did you eat that triggered craving? Now, there's something to be said, and I do this with a lot of people. Look, if you don't know what it is, because like me, I thought it was everything. Right? You know, people said alcoholic foods. My alcoholic foods, I thought, were food. That's what it is. It's just food. Well, then I may say, well, how about we try this? You know, how about you select, you know, some items that you know for sure can't produce the allergy of the body, can't produce the phenomenon of craving, and just eat those. Because there's nobody who comes in here that can't live for 90 days. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that. I'm not a doctor, but you know, you can pick foods in a natural form that come out a certain way and just live on those for 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. You're not going to get malnourished. And then see what happens. And then you can start adding stuff back in, right? But I had to stop looking at this thing like I said, with alcohol. Alcohol, you put it down, it's gone. It's out of your system. It's out of your system in just a couple of days. And foods, they linger for a long time. So you got to take, you got to figure out for yourself what they are. And I'll make suggestions on what they could try, but I don't make demands and I don't give instructions. That's not the role.
Thank you, Kate J. Celine M., star one to unmute.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you, everybody. This is Celine in Pennsylvania. I heard you say you don't have the power, but you do have agency. And you reinforced that by mentioning being responsible, accountable, and conceding. And it's a message that really resonates with me today. You did kind of address it more through the Q&A, but can you add anything about power versus agency?
Yeah, thank you for the question, right? You know, because some people, I thought power meant control, and it doesn't. It doesn't. It doesn't mean, you know, that power means for me.
Perhaps we lost you.
To unmute. Where'd I drop off? Sorry about that.
For me, you were saying
Oh, that would. I think that was early on. But my thinking, for instance, right? I can have certain thoughts about a particular subject, and I might not be able to change that subject, but I can change my perspective about the thing that's going on. See, most of the time I want to take what's happening as a direct threat to me. Oh, this was something that happened to me. This is something, you know, for me. Why did this happen? This always happens to me, right? Well, I have the ability to reevaluate what's going on and ask what really is going on. Is that particular thing really focused towards me? Is that just another person who's just like me trying to get their needs met, just like I'm trying to get my needs met? Right? So no, I don't have power over that. I don't have control over that, but I do have the ability to use my natural capabilities, right? God tells us that we all have the power of reason, right? It says it right in the big book. I have the ability to reevaluate situations and come to the appropriate conclusion. I can choose to make that conclusion serve me, or I can choose to have it not serve me. And when I choose to have it not serve me, I suffer. But if I choose to believe it's serving me in some way, this is happening for me, not to me, then I'm not the victim. Then I can get through whatever it is that I'm trying to get through, right? And that, to me, is power. That's power. It's actually referred to power in the big book. So I hope that clears it up.
Thank you, Celine. Maura Z, your turn.
Thank you, Leah. Thank you, Pete. It's always good to hear you. And I love that you focused on that particular sentence, because that's what you did for me many years ago. And I continue that with my sponsees. It's very important. That concession is absolutely important. And I thank you for focusing on that. My question, however, is, as a recovered sponsor, do you continue to work with a sponsor? And is there a study or something that you're working on? Or do you simply sponsor and that's the extent of your work in program? Thanks.
I don't know if I understood the question. Are you asking me? Thank you first of all for the question and then for the comments, Maura. It's always good to hear you. Are you asking, do I continue to have a sponsor, and is that what your question is? If you could just unmute and come
Yes. Do you still have a sponsor, and do you work on any particular projects with the sponsor, or are you just checking in with the sponsor?
Just between us girls, and to be honest, I don't. I mean, I have a number of spiritual advisors that I commune with on a regular basis. I have people, you know, I have been in the world of recovery for nearly three decades now, and everybody I know and socialize with, for the most part, I'm retired, are either, you know, people who I got sober with or got sober around, and, you know, but I don't have like a person who, you know, quote unquote, I'm accountable to for my behavior, or who I go to on a regular basis for consistent direction. I believe that there is a role for that, and it is useful and necessary for the process, but I also don't see anywhere that it's a requirement for the process. And I would much rather have no sponsor than somebody that's not informed about themselves and about the condition and about the process of recovery. And I, you know, that's my position on it. You know, like there, you know, these days it's different today than it was, you know, when they wrote the big book, and there's plenty of other resources to get the information. So like I said, I'd rather have none and read the book than somebody that's misinformed or somebody that's going to, you know, tell me or anyone that this is what something is and this is the way you do something. I know that's what the big book says, but this is the way we do it. So this is how you have to do it, and gives them those instructions versus doing what the role of a sponsor is to help them find, help a person you're working with find the answer to their inquiry, right? I never had a sponsor solve one of my problems. I hear a lot, you know, I hear a lot of people. They're a good resource to have. But once again, in working with others, it tells us where my dependence must rely, right? Tells me where it is. That's my position on that. Again, I'm not advocating for anyone to not have a sponsor, for anyone to not make outreach calls, for anyone to not do all of the things that people do in Overeaters Anonymous. I'm not saying don't do that. I'm saying every time that I was doing those things and relying on those things, I focused on them more than I focused on being abstinent, and I went back to the food, right? I got a sponsor who was armed with the facts about herself and the disease and the program of recovery. She directed me to that, and I had the spiritual experience that we said we were going to have, and my trust and my reliance and my dependence is on God. And should I find myself in a situation where I need a resource that doesn't exist or I don't have right now, I know at any point in time, I could pick up the phone, whether someone likes me or doesn't like me or knows me or doesn't know me, and they can hear what's going on. They can listen to whatever it is that I have to say about it, and they will offer their objective opinion about the subject, and I can choose to follow what they say, or I can choose to do whatever it is that I decide to do, and I will be the only one that either suffers or benefits from it. And that's my response.
Thank you, Maura, for your question. We have time for probably two more questions. Anyone else like to pose a question? Barbara K.
Leia F.
And Connie Yetta.
Okay.
Sally A.
Claudia C.
Okay. Maureen. I've got Barbara K., Hannah Yetta, and Sally A. Let's see if we can get through three. Barbara K., your question.
It's star one.
Barbara K., star one to unmute.
Okay, I'm here. Thanks so much, Pete. What are your thoughts on this? Because I go through this throughout my recovery, and I am recovered from alcohol, no problem with that. It's beautiful. But what do you think about when you feel like you're in the miracle of neutrality and you can take a bite of something, a bite of cake, which sugar I stay away from generally, and you're okay. You're okay for a couple of months. It's not like it is triggering the allergy. And then yet at other times, I go back into binging. Like I can be great for several months, even a year. And then eventually I go back into binging. So neutrality with food, having a bite, and just feeling like you're in fit spiritual condition and knowing that it's not going to trigger me because that's my experience. But then eventually, months down the road, I still go back into binging.
Thank you for the question. I kind of talked a little bit about that on the on the presentation, right? What happens, right? I lose predictability. And they say that alcohol, right, is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Cunning means that it waits in ambush. That's what it means, right? And this disease wants me to think I'm okay. It wants us to think I'm okay, right? I don't see anywhere in the big book that it says food neutrality is a result of the steps. It says neutrality, right? We have ceased fighting everybody and everything, even alcohol. If I'm thinking that somehow, for some reason, having a piece of cake is going to be okay, I haven't been restored to sanity. Sanity hasn't been restored. I'm still in the disease. I'm still delusional. I'm still having illusions that I can do something that I can't, that my history and the collective history of Overeaters Anonymous says I can't do. But I'm still choosing to believe I can. And then what happens? The disease backs you up. It says, you see, you can do this. This is okay. You're fine. Go back to weighing and measuring. You're going to be okay. And then what happens? The next another opportunity shows up. And it says, okay, see, it was okay that time. And then before you know it, you're like Bill on Armistice Day or whatever it all happened, right? You're wondering, how the hell did this happen? I'm pounding on the bar. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. See, I got to get abstinent, and I have to be entirely abstinent for long enough for those insane thoughts to stop. Does that mean I'm never going to walk past the bakery and say to myself, oh, that smells good? There's a reason why it smells good. Because the shit's delicious. It's beautiful. It's made to be that way. And that's great for every single other person except for me. Except for me. Because I'm not like other people. I'll never be like other people. That stuff will never be okay in any form, any shape, or any fashion. That's what sanity is. I wouldn't even entertain the thought. And I'll tell you this, I eat anything I want today. Anything I want, in any quantity I want. But the only thing I want to eat are foods that are clean and free of anything that could trigger the phenomenal craving. I don't want anything else, even though it looks pretty, even though it's gorgeous and smells delicious. I don't want it. And when I eat foods that don't trigger the phenomenal craving, miraculously, I eat only enough to satisfy the hunger that's inside me from the calories that I burned. Since we got close to a little bit of time left, I'll just say this. When I came to a vision for you, I was, 35% body fat. And I, got abstinent and followed a meal plan, and I got down to an appropriate body weight, and I still had high body fat. And my body has completely recomposed, and I've stayed between a pound or two of my ideal body weight. But what has shifted is the makeup of my body, because I do the things that I think my God would have me do, and I take care of my body, and I rest, and I exercise, and I do all those things, and I walk a free man. I think that might have been more than you asked for, so I'll pass with that.
Thank you, Barbara Kay. Hanayeta, your question, please.
Okay, this is Hanayeta R. from Texas. Thank you, Leia, for your always wonderful service that you do for us. PP, you know I love what you always say, and I always most of the time agree with you. But what I didn't hear, maybe you said it and I didn't hear it, is your day-to-day. Do you still write down a food plan? Do you do the 11-step every night and every morning? Well, I know you work with others, and so... So what does your day-to-day look like on a, yeah, every day? What does it look like? What do you do?
Thank you, Hani Yetta, for the question. Yeah, it is. What do I do? This is what I do, and I make everybody I work with do the same thing. I get up between 4 and 4:30 in the morning, and I take a cold plunge in water that's 49 degrees. Now, everybody has to do that. And then after I do that, I do a little bit of exercise, and then I pray and meditate. And I pray and meditate for 30 minutes, and everybody has to do that. I'm just kidding. That's a joke. I have practices. So just to specifically answer your question, I get up every single day and I tend to my spiritual practices. I meditate first, where I'm listening for guidance and directions from the God of my understanding. After that, I pray. I petition to God and ask for the strength, the courage, the power, and the conviction to not seek a drink or a drug or any substance that triggers the phenomenon of craving. I ask for some guidance and some things for the people I love in my life, and I move on from there. As soon as I'm finishing doing that, I make my plan for the day. And my plan for the day, the only things I'm worried about are the five to stay alive. What I'm going to eat, when I'm going to eat it, how much I'm going to eat, where it's going to come from, and I like to think about who I'm going to eat with, and I identify those things. After I finish that, I join the meeting. I chop it up and think about all the shares and everything that's going on, what the content is. Throughout the day, I practice the steps the way they're intended to practice. If I experience if I encounter selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, I do what the 10th step asked me to do. I do an 11th step also throughout the day, right? When I'm agitated, when I don't know what to do, I'm asking for guidance and direction. I'm working on a regular basis to align my will with God's. And at the end of the day, I do a review, the way the big book says to do a review. I constructively review my day. I'm not looking for the things I did wrong. I'm looking for the things I did right. And I'm giving grace, I'm giving gratitude, expressing gratitude to the God of my understanding for getting me through the day. And then when I retire and I sleep well. And I get up the next day and I do the same thing over and over again.
Thank you. Thank you, Hanietta, for the question. That's a great place to end. Sally A., I'm sorry, but I'm sure you'll be able to connect with Pete at another time. I want to thank everybody who posed questions this morning. And, of course, thank you so much, Pete, for your presentation this morning. Really profound and important words, in my opinion. Thank you so much. Share ID for today, 23,379. That's 2, 3, 3, 7, 9. We're going to close now from page 164. It's found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.